You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Rolling Stone executive editor Nathan Brackett. Today we're going to hear Keith Richards talk about his first guitar hero, Scotty Moore. But first, we're going to do a midsummer tour check-in. Instead of our usual what we're listening to segment, we're going to talk about what shows we've been going to and what our favorite ones have been. I have here Andy Green, Hi, associate editor. Hey, Andy. Patrick Doyle.
Hey.
Annie Licata.
Hi, guys.
What's up, Annie? All right, guys, this is the heat of the summer. We've all been going to a lot of shows. There have been a lot of festivals, a lot of major tours. Let's hear what have been your favorites so far. Let's start with Andy. What was your favorite show? What's been your favorite show so far?
My favorite show was Radiohead at Madison Square Garden.
Oh my God, that's one of my favorites too.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. Yeah, it's crazy.
That was last night. We all went.
We did.
Everybody except for Annie.
Guys, yeah, I didn't go.
Sorry, Annie.
I'm sorry. It was awesome.
Three of the four of us went, at least. Yeah, it was just very, very good. I saw the last tour a lot. This was significantly better. I feel Tom was more into it. He seemed happier.
That's Tom York for listeners.
Yeah, Tom York. Yeah, spelled T-H-O-M. But yeah, they played a lot of these old 90s songs they hadn't played in years. It was the first live letdown off of Okay Computer in 10 years.
This is, before we totally geek out on this is their first U.S. tour, right? Did you already say this? This is their first U.S. tour since?
Since 2012.
This is their first U.S. tour since 2012. Yes. There's the first time we've heard songs off their last album.
A Moon-Shaped Pool.
Their new album, yeah. A Moon-Shaped Pool. Mm-hmm. And I thought those songs sounded incredible. Those were like some of the highlights for me.
Yeah, the first five songs was the first five songs off the album in sequence, was the first half. And they worked really well live. And, you know, they're a bit slow at times, but they're beautiful. And the whole Reno was hushed for it. Then the energy just slowly built through the whole night. I don't know. It was really something. I've not seen them that good since 2001, even.
It was a combination of a band that's like happy where they are now and their new album, but then also, we were talking about this earlier, kind of totally happy to revisit some of their biggest songs. They weren't ducking their like Paranoid Android.
Right.
They went fierce version of that.
Through a period where they did very few songs pre-Kid A. When they do them, they sort of seem to be begrudgingly doing them.
Right. Okay. Here's a hit for you.
You know, here's like Carmen Police for the millionth time. But this time they played Planet Telex. You know, they played all this awesome shit.
Set on the bends.
Yeah. It was just incredible. I mean, Street Spirit at the very end was incredibly moving.
It was gorgeous. And the whole arena was singing along.
Yeah.
And one thing that struck me on the way out is just people were just cheering spontaneously, just filing out of the arena, which was just for no apparent reason.
They looked next to me, and this girl was just smiling. Like, she looked at me and smiled. Like, it was just something you don't, this communal feeling that you get at, you don't see at a lot of shows. Like, you know, you're usually getting bumped into.
This is the special FOMO edition of Rolling Stone Music Now. Yeah.
It
was just a great show.
Joy.
Yeah, absolutely. If people can get tickets for this Radiohead tour, they need to. Okay, so Patrick, what about you?
Well, let's see. When I went back home to Maine and I saw Phish, it's where I grew up. So Phish played at this small arena called the.
You only see Phish in Maine.
Yeah,
right?
There's like a 2 week period where I love Phish, but I immerse myself in like the week before that show and the week after, and it's kind of always in July, early July. And get the Phish app on my phone.
Just the cycle
and,
of life. And
Phish, and I still have it on my phone. And it's an amazing. There's two apps. There's the Phish Live app and the regular Phish app. But I have. Then you can go to the reviews, and there's like 37 reviews for every show. People detailed, just you know. The
wonderful thing,
thing
is that the members of Phish are probably just as excited about all these Phish apps as you are. I mean, there's a certain like, everybody, they love to geek out about this stuff.
Yeah. So Phish played at, it was the smallest show, I believe, of the whole tour. It was, every other show was like, you know, Red Rocks or Dick's Sporting Goods Amphitheater. And this was at a Civic Center, which is this 8,000 top crowd. Wow. And so they played, it was the hottest show I maybe ever been to, but they just it wasn't a whole lot of jamming as much, you know, that was the one thing all these fans were complaining about, but there was a very melodic show. Everything Trey was playing had real melody to it. Everybody was really playing well together, and it was almost a feeling like that Radiohead show where everyone was so happy to be in there because it was such a tough ticket, and outside the whole scene, people, you know, selling a Heady Topper beer, which is very hard to get, and this is the from Vermont, just this hippie scene that you see up there in New England. But then getting the chance, I talked to Trey before the show, and they did a sound check, and I watched the sound check. It was the most amazing things I've ever seen because they played for an hour, a lot of blues, a lot of just kind of letting themselves loose on this, wow, like kind of like Hendrix-y stuff, like Prince stuff. Like it was just kind of, you get to see what they were really into and trying out new songs from their next album. And Trey talked about one thing that was interesting that he said is his favorite types of shows to play are the small arena shows, because he got into playing live albums through Peter Frampton, Frampton Comes Alive, and The Who.
That's interesting. So not theaters, not clubs, not big arenas, but small arenas.
Yeah, he said Who live at Leeds and Frampton Comes Alive, that he said these 70s rock arenas are his favorite kind of shows to play.
The 8 to 10,000 capacity zone. All right, remember that, small bands.
I saw them. I saw them this summer too.
Oh,
I saw
you
them
see
in
them?
Connecticut. I drove like 3 hours to see them because I always try to get out to see Fish at least once every summer. And they were fun. I had such a good time. I saw them in an arena that size, and the last time they had played there, they played the Beatles album, the White Album, all the way through. Mm-hmm. So I saw them at that size arena, and that was a great show, too. So
you
maybe
can
that's
attest to their playing at small arenas being a good thing. All right.
Yes, I can.
All right, but anyway, so what was your favorite show this summer, though?
I saw Beyonce at Citi Field, and that was phenomenal. That was
pretty
amazing. You saw them.
I did, too. Yes. No, go ahead, though.
She was just, it was everything that I could have asked for out of a Beyonce show.
And you're a serious fan. You can ask a lot out of a Beyonce show.
Yes, I've been a lifelong Beyonce fan. I've been there since Destiny's Child. And she played, you know, she like got down on her knees and sang 1+1. Like she just sang her heart out, and her dancing was just on point. And just the production, the whole thing, the huge monolith type thing, and she really just brought so much energy and
what is this thing, the monolith?
She had this thing on the stage that was like the 2001 monolith. It was like huge,
but it was surrounded by video
screens. Yeah, and like she did a Prince cover, and like the whole thing turned purple, and there was a lot of what you expected to hear from Lemonade, but she also went back and did a lot of really amazing old songs that some of her, you know, she said during the show, like, I know some of you guys have been with me since day one, so she played some of those older songs, and I've never seen her before, so I was very moved.
She is, as I said, I was at one of those shows too, and she's just a stadium killer. It's just crazy. Just the combination of her voice and the dancing and the whole production is just, it's just really another level.
Yeah, she just commanded the whole, that's a hard venue to have control over like that, and everybody was just blown away.
For sure. All right, well, let's move on to some negativity. What have been the biggest disappointments for you guys? Or you know, medium-level disappointments? Yeah. Or
this is April. It's not quite the summer, but the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony, to me, was some disappointments.
Well, that was a spicy ceremony.
It was spicy.
Steve Miller saying all that stuff.
But he was okay as a performer. I was looking forward to seeing NWA play, but they decided not to even play.
True.
I was looking forward to seeing Chicago play with Pierce Terra. I am not a fan of Chicago, but 25 or 6 to 4 is a great song. I'm a fan of their one song, basically.
Right. Or maybe Saturday in the Park.
I hate that song.
All right.
But 25 or 6 to 4 is a jam. And Pierce
Terra. Can I just throw in Chicago's one of those bands that you don't think you're going to look forward to? I mean, they're freaking Chicago, you know, unless you're of a certain demographic and they're huge on the radio. But then you actually think about all their songs. You're thinking, I like that song. I want to see that.
I hate almost all of them, but 25 to the 4 is amazing. Green Day stole like brains through off it, and Peter Cetera, who sings the song, was supposed to come and sing it with him. And he hadn't sang with them in like 22 years or something. But they got into a big fight over what key they would sing it in, and he didn't show. So they played it in their new crappy way, and it was disappointing.
Some intra-band squad.
Right, and Deep Purple I was looking forward to seeing, because that could be Ritchie Blackmore for the first time in 20 years, and he didn't show up.
Right.
And they didn't even bring out Glenn Hughes to play with them. It was just a lot of missed opportunities at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and it was just disappointing.
Right.
Okay, but Cheap Trick was all right.
But Cheap Trick at the end.
All right.
Totally right, Danny. At the end, Cheap Trick came out and saved the day.
Patrick, what about you?
Mine was a little more recent, a little more fresh.
April. Not long ago.
What about further back, Andy? Are there any shows that are further back?
Go way back. Yeah, I saw Robert Palmer in 1994 and was disappointed. But yeah,
mine was just this past weekend at MetLife Stadium. It was Guns N' Roses, and I actually went with Andy, and we had very different thoughts on the whole thing. And I just really did not like the show. I thought that I've never seen any band go through the motions more than this show. There was no chemistry, you know, between Slash and Axl.
This is a major tour this summer. This is, this is really disappointing.
It was.
I don't know what you expected. You expect them to go out there and hug and go back in time to the 80s? I mean, it was amazing. Slash sounded great. It was Axl's voice has not sounded that great in a very long time.
Killed it. What were your expectations going in, Patrick?
I expected to see an exciting band. An exciting band who really bring those songs to life on stage. I expected myself to really become sort of immersed in this, you know, this great energy that they have.
And I don't think those expectations are out of line. I mean, I didn't see Guns N' Roses, but they were for, you know, that performance without Axl in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame a few years ago, going back to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, was incredible. I mean, totally kicked
this was
butt.
Much
and
better.
And that's with the guy from Alter Bridge. So you would think with Axl Rose.
Yeah, but I saw them at the Hammerstein Ballroom a few years ago, and I just expected, since the huge stink that they're making about this particular lineup, that going from clubs to stadiums, that it would be radically different. But, you know, Axl basically is on stage half of the show. The rest of the time he's backstage getting oxygen. And Slash is, you know, just doing instrumental things. Slash is an amazing guitar player, but once he goes into his fifth, you know.
So you're saying there was Slash would have to fill time.
He would be killing time. He did like the Godfather theme, which was cool, but there were a lot of other instrumental things that, with the other hired guitarists that they have now. But they were
Richard Fortus.
Yeah. And they just. So I felt like half the show was just killing time, and then Axl would get the energy finally to come out and do something, but it wasn't really a whole lot.
I find half is a gross overstatement. Maybe like a fifth of it.
Andy, you have 30 seconds to rebut this.
I felt that part of going to a concert like that is to manage expectations. This was never going to be like
part of going to a concert is to manage expectations.
Well, if you're seeing Guns N' Roses in 2016, it's not going to feel like 1987 again. But Axl is not sounding that good.
When neither of you guys were like alive, right?
I was six.
Okay,
I'm old. I wasn't going to concerts back then, but I've seen the videos. I thought it was as good as it possibly could have been, all things considered. Considering you have a guitarist and singer that probably don't speak off stage, that you don't have Izzy Stradlin there, that Axl is in his mid-50s now and everything, I still thought for all of that it was great.
So you're taking a holistic, somewhat apologistic approach to
Guns N' Roses. No, I loved it. There were very few moments where I was like, this sucks, and it was usually when Axl was on stage.
All right.
I loved it.
Annie, what was your biggest disappointment this summer?
I saw early 2000s Nostalgia Tour with Taking Back Sunday and Dashboard Confessional. Yep. And
we don't all speak your emo shorthand, Annie.
That was my time. Those are huge bands when I was like really coming into.
Emo's back, man. This should be a big tour, right?
So I was really excited, and it was not good. There was a really bad turnout. Apparently, I'm the only one. Me and like a couple of other people still want to see those bands.
Really?
Yeah. And Taking Back Sunday was just really bad, and they didn't sound very good, and which is a shame because they have a new album coming out, so I'm sure they're trying to like get their mojo back. Dashboard was all right. Saves the Day, which was one of my favorite. I love Saves the Day. And they were underwhelming as well. So the whole thing, I mean, it was to the point where they actually let the people who were on the lawn move up into the seats because the arena was so empty. And anytime that happens, you know that that's like a bad sign. Aww. So I was disappointed.
Emo's not as back as we thought.
No, it's definitely
It's a good lesson. It's too soon for the nostalgia. It's like the Monkees tried to tour in the mid-70s and nobody cared. But by the mid-80s, it was back in arenas. Right. You have to time it right. And if you just wait 10 years, there's not enough nostalgia that builds yet.
Right.
That's with the New Kids on the Block. They had to wait like 20 years and it was huge again. You have to time it.
Right.
And they jumped the gun.
Yeah, they totally did.
Well, let's try to end on an up note. What tours are we looking forward to? What shows? Patrick, do you want to start?
Well, Bruce Springsteen is coming to MetLife Stadium, and he does this every couple years, coming and does a run of a few shows at MetLife, and I just love this end of August. I think he gave a whole speech last time. This is when you can see the flies out, and the air is a certain kind of stickiness, I guess, but
because you're in a swamp.
Yeah, but it's
an actual swamp.
Yeah, but he
literal
Bruce
swamp
made
there.
It sound very romantic the last time he.
Well, of course, this is the station that replaced that. Sorry, the stadium that replaced the
stadium,
that giant stadium that was a wrecking ball.
He wrote Wrecking Ball. Yeah. I saw that show where he played Wrecking Ball. Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to going all three.
All right.
Yes,
Andy,
I'm
what about
also
you?
Looking forward to the Bruce shows there, and seeing
no repeats.
What? Well, I've said also I have my own. And what I'm looking most forward to is seeing Neil Young and Promise of the Real, because they've been in Europe all summer playing these crazy set lists, 3-hour shows, playing all these songs that he hasn't played in decades. And they're going to come back here, and I'm really psyched about seeing that show.
All right. Well, Annie, what about you?
I saw Lake Street Dive at the Beacon in the winter, and they're doing a fall tour, and they were really good live. They were amazing.
Live, yeah.
And her voice, the lead singer, Rachel Price, sounds exactly the same live. And when I saw them at the Beacon, it was a perfect venue size for them. And they covered Annie Lennox's Walking on Broken Glass, which is one of my favorite songs
and
of
Annie
all time.
And Annie Lennox has got such a great voice. I mean, to pull off a song like that,
yeah,
you have to be able to sing.
They just killed it. So I'm really excited for their fall tour.
Cool. I'm looking forward to, one of my favorites so far was FKA Twigs at the Panorama Fest, which was just this weekend.
Yeah.
She was incredible. It was just like performance art. She's this incredible choreographer and singer, and she's going to be coming back at some point in the next year with a new album. So I'll be looking forward to it. I don't think she has any actual dates, but she might have a scattering of dates in the U.S., so I would definitely point people to her. So that's our midsummer
Wait,
tour
who are
report.
Are you disappointed by it?
I don't have any, man. I mean, I went to the Panorama Fest this weekend, as I mentioned, to see FKA Twigs, and I was disappointed in the heat. It was about 98 degrees and really muggy, and so I was disappointed in that. I was a little underwhelmed by Kurt Vile, who I'm a fan of, but other than that, I haven't had any major disappointments this summer, knock on wood. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the summer still has another month in it, so we'll
Kurt
see.
Kurt Vile is not so good.
But I guess that's our midsummer tour report. We'll check in maybe at the end of the summer or early next summer or the end of the year. And I appreciate you guys coming on.
Sure.
Thanks.
All right. And that was a little bit of Mystery Train by Elvis Presley featuring the awesome guitar of Scotty Moore. I'm back here with Patrick, and we're going to talk about your recent conversation with Keith Richards about Scotty Moore, and we're also going to listen to a little bit of that conversation.
Yeah.
So Scotty Moore, Elvis Presley's great guitarist, just died a few weeks ago. So Patrick, do you want to talk about Scotty Moore's importance to Keith?
Yeah, well, Keith Richards, you know, the most immediate person that you think of when you think of Keith's influence would be Chuck Berry. But
right.
The guy he was listening to before that was Scotty Moore. He has a famous quote that he said, you know, everybody wanted to be Elvis, I wanted to be Scotty. So Scotty Moore's rhythm guitar playing he's one of the most interesting guitar players, I think, to ever pick up the instrument. He joined Elvis in 1954 and was his manager during that time. I really don't think Elvis would be Elvis without
right.
Scotty. He was booking him in these fairs and these tiny clubs as they would ride across the South playing. And so basically, Scotty helped engineer his career and also his sound. And his rhythm guitar playing, as Keith kind of said, is sort of a mix of country, blues, and jazz. And it's very hard to kind of replicate.
And Keith, just to throw in, like Keith, of course, is like one of the great rhythm guitar players. This master of vibe and feel.
Yeah.
And if you listen to those early, you know, those Elvis records, the Mystery Train,
mm-hmm.
and That's All Right. I mean, that guitar playing is just like, he's just such a master of vibe. And
yeah.
Such evocative records.
Yeah, and Keith describes his playing as the ancient form of weaving, which is what he does with Ronnie Wood or Mick Taylor or Brian Jones, and it's where both people are playing kind of rhythm and lead at the same time. And Scotty was doing that.
It goes back to the Mesopotamians.
Scotty was doing that. He was sort of weaving with himself because there would always be the rhythm going on those songs like Mystery Train, but he'd always go in and out of it with these tangents he'd go on. And as a rudimentary guitar player for like 12 years, longtime rudimentary guitar player, Scotty's playing is some of the hardest to learn and to replicate because the rhythm is very complicated and it sounds easy, but then you look up these YouTube videos on how to do it, and it's very, very hard, especially Mystery Train. It sounds like a couple chords, but it's very hard to get down, the finger picking and the chords going at the same time. So that was very intriguing to Keith. You know, Keith called Mystery Train the apex of all guitar playing, basically, of Elvis's guitar playing. So he was impressed by not only his guitar playing, but also the sound that they found in the Sun Studios. It was this little echo chamber, kind of. And it was only three guys most of the time. Early on, there were no drums. It was just Scotty and Bill Black on bass. And Elvis kind of playing acoustic guitar, but mostly Scotty and Bill. And they could just make this huge sound. And that is what got Keith interested in the chemistry of a group.
All right. Well, without any further ado, let's get into your conversation with Keith Richards. This was a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Patrick, it's Keith.
Hey, Keith. Man, you're always on time or early. It's awesome.
Synchronized watches.
what have you been up to?
Lately, it's kicking back for the summer, but a couple of weeks ago I was in London with the Stones. We cut a few tracks
for
a few days. It's interesting, yeah.
How'd that go?
It went very well, yeah. It's great fun.
Awesome.
Always is.
Oh, that's so cool. It must be cool to be back in the studio with those guys.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking the time to talk about Scotty, who I know was a major, major influence on you.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, Scotty was probably... He's a guy, I think I could say that that's when I wanted to go electric. You know, it took me a while because I was sort of playing, I was sort of working in the folk area, you know, and also I couldn't afford an electric guitar at the time. So, his style of playing with that early Elvis stuff is just, it's still like the. It's the creme de la creme, you know, of early rock and roll playing. And those guys, there are no drums on some of those tracks even. It's amazing.
You don't notice it either.
No, I mean, Mystery Train, which is probably the apex of their sound. It's just Bill Black and always his acoustic in the background of Scotty. It's the most amazingly huge sound, and always, and also Scotty Moore and the sound he got also made me start to get interested in recording and echoes and stuff like that before I even got into it. But it made me interested in the possibilities of recording studio.
Yeah. And it was very primitive what they were doing, with the way they were working with.
Yeah, I mean, it's so simple, you know. With the right guys, obviously it can be done. I mean, Bill Black was an amazing bass player, and sometimes not having drums gives you a freedom to the rhythm that it unlocks certain other rhythms that you can't get when you're with a drummer, you know. So a great sound, and it's never been duplicated, and I don't think anybody would try because it's unique, you know, a unique sound.
Are there any Stones tracks tracks that you know that you've done that you were were work that you were trying to channel that Scotty Moore sound?
I never tried to copy it, ever. Although, sometimes I would fool around with certain echoes, maybe in Parachute Woman and stuff. You know, probably more in the recording technique than in the playing. But, it was such a sweet guy, too. And at the same time, he could get his chops around the blues and country music, like and a mixture of it, which is still quite Well, it's unique. It was unique. I mean, Elvis wouldn't have been Elvis without Scotty, you know.
No, he said that his two major influences were Les Paul and Chet Atkins, and he didn't listen to a whole lot of other guys before, you know.
Yeah,
when he was in the
and then you, see, then you get the sense of Scotty Moore was into the electrics of the electric guitar, rather than just being a guitar player. Mm-hmm. You know, with people like Les Paul and Chet Atkins, who were both innovators of inventors of the damn thing.
Yeah, and you mentioned Mystery Train and the way I was just
exactly.
as an amateur guitar player myself. I watch YouTube videos where they try to teach you how to do that song because there's so much going on that you don't realize the syncopation and cutting off chords and partial chords and the right hand stuff, and it's the riff kind of turns around on itself.
It is. It's amazing. Amazing. I mean, that's really what we know about Scotty Moore is those relatively few tracks. I mean, it was quite a lot with Elvis, but I mean, you don't really know of any other work. I said something just came together with those boys, you know. The one-off. Magic Elvis was incredible at that age.
19 years old or something.
Yeah, he didn't age quite as well as he could have. But amazing at 19, 20 years old, that stuff. I mean, it was mind-boggling.
Yeah, do you remember where you were when you first heard that sound?
Well, I must have been at home on the radio, man. Yeah, I mean, it was one of those. I think Heartbreak Hotel was the first one I heard, which electrified me. And then soon after, I checked out the first album, you know, Money Honey, Baby Let's Play Your House, you know, Milk Cow Blues Boogie, which is an incredible piece of guitar playing. Love that. Lick.
Yeah, I don't care if the sun don't shine and you're a heartbreaker. Those are two also.
Yeah, the heartbreak is beautiful too. And, yeah, I left, you're right, she's gone, man. We can throw these things at each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he only got, I mean, I think $30,000 for he estimated for his entire work with Elvis during but the 50s, you know. Do you think that he should have been a more well-known or more rewarded for his work?
I think, but then I think if you're working for the Colonel, good luck. Good damn luck. Yeah, I mean, they got the paid scale for, everything they did was just including like Jailhouse Rock and everything. what was amazing to me too was that DJ Fontana and Scotty were great pals. They were hanging around together, forever. Whenever I saw Scotty, almost invariably DJ would be there as well. Great pals, which is, heartening.
Yeah. So you were at went to do that song Deuce and a Quarter with the Levon.
Yeah, with Levon. Yeah.
And that's amazing track. What was that day like for you?
That was great. We went up to Woodstock to leave on, and Garth was there. Garth Hudson.
Oh wow!
Scotty. It was just a great session, man. It was the good old boys.
Yeah, yeah. Dude, was that a surreal experience to play with these guys that you would listen to as a kid?
Yeah, a real pleasure to play, I mean, it always has been. I've sort of gotten used to it over the years, especially, I started with Little Richard when I was about 19, playing, so, I mean, that was my first, I'm sitting in the dressing room, playing guitar to Little Richard's piano, and I was saying, this'll do,
But the those guys didn't play a whole lot, so to see them in action must have been incredible.
Yeah, it was. It was. He's such a smooth style, Scotty, too. Levon, great drummer, man.
The last thing about Scotty, you were mentioning the smooth style and the combination of the jazz and country stuff. Is there anything else you would say that he sort of... the hallmarks of his style that you...
We've got to mention, there's a great grounding in the blues as well. Mm-hmm. He sort of covered it, just about everything, you know. I mean, there's a little jazz in there, some great country licks. I mean, he was a unique character in a way. There'll never be another Scotty Moore, that I can say.
What was he like as a person?
Very gentle, very funny, very unassuming, you know, like most of it, it's very, you know, very quiet, in fact. He did like his scotch. That's, he ain't called Scotty for nothing.
What's that?
He ain't called Scotty for nothing. He did like his, well, he did like scotch whiskey.
Oh, I bet there was a lot that day at Levon's house.
Yeah, plenty.
With Scotty, you were saying that there's not that much out there from him that we heard from Scotty. Do you have any, I mean, that he, you know, Elvis, they did the 68 stuff together, but they didn't do a lot more. They didn't do anything after
that. No, at that time I was hoping that they would pick up the threads together again, but it didn't happen, did it?
No, I was just curious if you knew why they'd ever worked together ever.
Probably still, they probably still playing him scale.
Yeah. Did you ever, was there a toughest Scotty Moore lick that you tried to nail down that you never, like, could quite get?
There's a rundown that he does on several tracks, which I've never, ever been able to figure out. When I ask Scotty, he just gives me a sly grin.
And that's it for today's episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. If you like what you heard, please leave a review on the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.